This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our fifth episode. We get to look at another impactful article from the JCENM that will help us better understand how to provide care to our patients with polycystic ovarian syndrome. The authors that we'll look at today used an observational study design for their investigation, and understanding the relevant inferential methods will help us better assess their conclusions. I'm excited to have two endocrinologists with clinical expertise in this field join me today for Endocrine Feedback Loop. As a reminder, I practice general endocrinology at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where I teach in and help oversee the fellowship program. Today, our regular contributor and expert educator is Anna Goldman. She works at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where she is the associate program director for their fellowship program. She provides care for a variety of endocrine conditions, but has a focus on andrology, as well as a research background in that area. This month, our guest expert is Andrea Dunay from Mount Sinai in New York City. She is the chief of the endocrine division there. Importantly for our discussion today, she is a world leader in clinical research and care of individuals with PCOS. We couldn't have a better pair of endocrinologists for this episode. And as with each of our episodes, everything said today will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. Today, we are discussing fertility and pregnancy outcomes in women with polycystic ovary syndrome following bariatric surgery. This study comes to us from the Hospital Universitario Ramon y Cajal in Madrid, Spain, with Estela Benito as the first author. It was published in the September print edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. And now I will turn things over to Anna, who will guide our discussion through the introduction, including what we need to understand about PCOS and key points that the authors make. Anna?
Thanks, Chase. So as we know, polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, is likely the most common metabolic disorder in premenopausal women. It's frequently associated with obesity, hyperinsulinism, and insulin resistance, and hyperandrogenism. As PCOS is a heterogeneous condition, I was hoping that Andrea would be able to review the guidelines for the diagnosis of PCOS and comment on what she thinks may be the underlying etiologies leading to this phenotype.
So the diagnostic guidelines for PCOS are the subject of ongoing controversy. The first guidelines, the so-called NIH guidelines, were determined by a vote of a group of experts. And those diagnostic criteria are hyperandrogenism and chronic anovulation. The clinical sign of that is irregular cycles, and with exclusion of other disorders. And it was realized even at that time that polycystic ovarian morphology was a nonspecific finding. In 2003, there was another expert conference, not a consensus conference, where ovarian morphology was added as a diagnostic criterion, and it was 2 out of 3. So that added 2 additional phenotypes, hyperandrogenism and polycystic ovarian morphology, and polycystic ovarian morphology and chronic anovulation. There's been a lot of work contrasting the phenotypes, and the phenotype with the metabolic disorder, what I like to call endocrinologist PCOS, is really the NIH phenotype. And we know there that knowing what the ovaries look like don't really add to our management of the patients. So I think the way these patients were diagnosed is standard in endocrine practices, having just hyperandrogenism and chronic anovulation. They mention that in morbidly obese women, it is difficult to do accurate ultrasonography.
So we know that generally marked weight loss through bariatric surgery has been found to restore all of the hormonal derangements of PCOS and also to restore regular menstrual cycles. Perhaps we could all discuss why this isn't the preferred approach. Chase or Andrea?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was looking at this and reading that description and looking into that, it certainly stands out, I think, in stark contrast to both what we know from research that's out there and certainly from clinical care of these individuals is that it's awfully challenging. While there are a variety of medical treatment options that we can provide, they take a prolonged period of time to have a full impact. And often, while it may help ameliorate the symptoms, it seems it's very uncommon that we have full resolution of a lot of those bothersome manifestations of PCOS. And so it did stick out to me as a big outlier as far as the treatment options that we have, and certainly did make me wonder why that's not a more common recommendation for our patients with PCOS to consider this as a much more effective, certainly more drastic, but more effective treatment option for PCOS.
The outcomes with bariatric surgery in women with PCOS are really excellent, and the patients are very, very satisfied afterwards. I think there is considerable reluctance on the part of the patients to have bariatric surgery, and I think that's kind of true in general. It seems like a big step, an aggressive procedure. So we don't see a lot of patients asking for that for management, but when they do, the outcomes are good. I think another important factor is when women are interested in fertility, they're not usually interested in waiting a year or two, which is what's advised with bariatric surgery.
Right. So we do have data suggesting that surgically induced weight loss from bariatric surgery does lead to an improvement in ovulation. Why did we need to do this study? Why can't we just assume that improvement in ovulation leads to improved fertility?
Well, I think really some of the landmark work that's been done in infertility and PCOS is by the Reproductive Medicine Network. And one of the big contributions that they've made is that the outcome we should be interested in, and our patients are certainly interested in, is the take-home baby rate. So conception is not taking home a baby 9 months later. And that is very, very clearly demonstrated in the randomized controlled trials with clomiphene, citrate, and metformin, and showing, although the ovulation rates with clomiphene and metformin were similar, the take-home baby rate was almost twice as much with clomiphene. So there are things going on between conception and final delivery that we don't understand, and how that ovulation is created, what the hormonal environment is very important, and it's much more than just a positive pregnancy test or a progesterone level.
Sure. All right, so then the big question of this article was, does restoration of ovulation after bariatric surgery in obese women with PCOS actually result in improved fertility? So Chase, perhaps if you could take us through the methods.
Thank you, Anna. You've done a nice job there of walking us through what's a challenging condition and showing us where we are at right now and why we need better understanding of what our treatment options are and the benefits of that. So what we'll do, as we typically do when we walk through the methods, the first thing that we'll take a look at is the study design, the inferential method that's employed here, because I think understanding that will help us much better understand exactly how the authors went about trying to answer the question that Anna summarized for us. And the authors use a retrospective cohort study design. So the way that works, as a reminder, is a cohort is your group of individuals, all of the individuals who are in the study are part of your cohort, and they share something in common. And in this study, the cohort are women who are obese, who underwent bariatric surgery. So that is something that the entire group has in common. And then what you do with that cohort is you split them into subgroups. It's typically two groups based on an exposure. And in its simplest form, you have one group who was exposed to something and the other group who is unexposed. And in this study, the exposure is PCOS. So you have part of your cohort has PCOS, that's their exposure, and the other doesn't. We'll look at the details of exactly how that was defined here shortly. And then what you do is you follow these individuals over time for the development of an outcome. And an outcome can be a variety of things. It can be something bad, a negative effect, or it can be, as in this case, something good. And the outcome in this study is pregnancy. And just like Andrea and Anna talked about, that's really key. And I think was an important aspect of this study is that it was an outcome that patients care about, not just that researchers care about, but it is the ultimate goal of any intervention that would be considered here. So what makes this a cohort study is that there is a time component. So you have a beginning of this study period, and then you follow these individuals, exposed and unexposed, over time for the development of an outcome. What makes it retrospective is when the study was started. Retrospective cohort studies start after everything is done, so to speak. It is after the outcomes have occurred. It's frequently done by looking through a database or a chart review, as was the case here, and looking through data that has already been collected. That is in contrast to prospective cohort studies. Prospective cohort studies, while they still have that time component, the actual investigation begins at the very beginning. Right after you split your cohort into exposed and unexposed, you start your study before the outcome has occurred, and you're following those individuals in real time, so to speak. So this is a retrospective cohort study. So a bit more of the details about how they worked that out. So the number of patients, there were 216 individuals, all premenopausal women, and they were identified, as we discussed, retrospectively. And these are all individuals who underwent bariatric surgery, and the dates for the surgery was between 2005 and 2015. And another component of this is that the data collection went all the way through 2019. And the authors described that a big part of that is, and Andrea referenced this already, is because individuals were instructed that if they were interested in fertility, that they should wait at least a year after the surgery before attempting to get pregnant. And so I did think it would be helpful just to actually take a pause here before we go into the methods further to help us understand, because Andrea already pointed out that that may be a possible reason why surgery is not used as frequently as it could be because of that delay afterwards. So Andrea, could you shed a little light as to why this was recommended, if this is a standard recommendation, and exactly why that would be if so?
There is a standard recommendation for women not to become pregnant in the first year to two after bariatric surgery because they're in a phase, especially early on, of rapid weight loss. There's concern about their nutrient balance being a negative energy balance. And for women with PCOS, there's some very intriguing data in the literature where women have been placed on very low calorie diets and then gone on to IVF. And the IVF outcomes are worse. So there's a general concern in the PCOS field, although recent data hasn't supported this. This is a non-bariatric surgery weight loss, that the weight loss itself, because of negative energy balance, may adversely affect pregnancy outcomes.
Thank you. That was helpful to get more of an understanding there. And as yet another aside, it's always helpful when you're going through these to look at all of the approaches, all of these steps that the investigators use and to ensure that they're similar to either a standard of care or at least the care that you provide. Because the closer that is to the type of patients that you see, the care that you provide, the more likely it is that any results that the authors find will be applicable to the patients that you provide care for. So good to see that is a widely accepted standard of care that they employed. As far as the diagnosis of PCOS, Andrea also mentioned this earlier, is there are two key components that the authors used. And that is that there had to be evidence of at least oligo ovulation and hyperandrogenism. And the hyperandrogenism could be either biochemical or clinical. And all of these individuals underwent testing so that they could be excluded for imitators of PCOS. So they were evaluated for hyperprolactinemia, for non-classic CAH, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and also evidence of androgen secreting tumors based on biochemical testing. And the authors point out, as we also discussed earlier, is that ovarian imaging was not used in this in these individuals because of limitations imposed by the severe obesity. And Andrea, you mentioned this already, but any pause that gives you, or from your perspective, the hallmark of PCOS is the ovulatory dysfunction and the hyperandrogenism, and so it's not maybe really a big deal that we don't have a good sense of what their ovarian morphology is.
I think we don't need to be concerned about the ovarian morphology in terms of making the diagnosis of PCOS. In the words of the 2012 expert meeting on PCOS, the ovarian morphology, the focus on PCOS, is really a distraction. What we're talking about is an endocrine disorder. Now, one caveat that's important, so my reproductive endocrine friends don't become furious, is that when you're doing assisted reproductive technologies and giving women with PCOS, particularly exogenous gonadotropins, ovaries that have polycystic ovarian morphology, even in the absence of other features of the syndrome, are hyper-responsive to gonadotropins. And those women are at risk for ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which can be very, very serious. And so it's essential in that setting to know what the ovaries look like. But in this setting, to make the diagnosis of the syndrome, it's not.
Excellent. So that helps us understand that there is absolutely a role in certain circumstances for ovarian imaging. But as far as our end, the endocrine aspect of that, of making a diagnosis of PCOS and potentially that transition to considering a surgery, even as far as for the purpose of fertility benefit, that would not be a key one, but a different conversation if we're thinking about other assisted reproductive techniques in that assessment. And of note, of the women who were included in this study, 9 had already been diagnosed with PCOS. As we'll see, far more were eventually found to have PCOS during this investigation, but 9 individuals at the time of this had already been told that they had PCOS. And we're going to look at this a little bit later. We're going to wait until we turn this over to Anna to walk us through the results. But this will be an area that we at least need to consider the possibility that this could have introduced a bias. This will be a little bit easier to think about as Anna walks us through the first table that gives us some details about the patient characteristics. It is the typical place to think about this. So we'll return to that possibility at that time. So the control group, so this would be the individuals who were not exposed to PCOS using that terminology of retrospective cohort studies. The control group were women who had both regular menses and who lacked both clinical and biochemical evidence of hyperandrogenism on the initial testing. As far as the bariatric surgery that was performed, the type of surgery that was performed was largely dependent upon the BMI of the individuals. So if the individual had a BMI that was greater than 45, there was a preference for a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. So of the 216 premenopausal women who underwent bariatric surgery in this study, approximately 50%, so 96, underwent a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And another roughly 50%, so 94, had a sleeve gastrectomy. There was a much smaller group of individuals, 15, who had a gastric band, and then another 11 individuals who initially had a gastric band but then underwent revision, either just had that removed or had that removed and then later had one of the other forms of bariatric surgery. An important part, and something that we'll come to later in the discussion, is that all individuals in this study were asked about their desire for fertility. So this information was collected initially at that first visit to the bariatric surgery clinic, and then after the surgery, within 2 years, that was reassessed. And the terminology that was used by the authors is the individuals, the women in this study, were asked whether they were seeking fertility actively. And the outcome, which we talked about, was very nicely done, a very patient-focused, clinically relevant outcome, with the primary outcome being pregnancy rate. And so they use the total number of pregnancies divided by the total number of women in each of the group, the exposed and the unexposed group. And before we wrap up the method section, I think one helpful thing, one nice thing that the authors did that we wanted to talk about is that they performed a power calculation. So as a brief review, typically a power calculation is done in an RCT, a randomized controlled trial. And in that situation, the purpose is to figure out how many subjects, how many individuals need to be enrolled into your trial so that if you have a finding that's important at the end of your study, you can have confidence that it is a significant finding, that you enroll enough individuals to tease out a difference between two groups. Now, this was not an RCT, as we talked about already, so the primary purpose here was a little bit different. And so that is because the authors are going to look to try to see if there is a difference in fertility between these two groups. They wanted to help give some confidence that if they either found a difference or did not find a difference, that one being the relevant, the not finding a difference, that they had enrolled enough subjects to where they should be able to find a difference if there was one. So they did a power calculation for that purpose and determined that they needed at least 103 individuals in this study in order for a finding of no difference between the groups to be meaningful from a statistical purpose. So I think that was helpful. We're going to take a look at exactly how they did that and some limitations related to that when we come back to that in the discussion. So hopefully you have a little bit better understanding both of retrospective cohort studies in general and then how that was applied in this study. And then we'll keep that in mind as a framework for our discussion as we move on to the results, which Anna is going to walk us through at this point.
Sure. So using the exclusion criteria that Chase already described, in figure one, we see that of 216 premenopausal women, 53 women, or 24.5%, met the criteria for polycystic ovarian syndrome. There were 145 women in the control group, or 67.1%. And then they describe 18 women who had this uncertain diagnosis, either because they had mild oligomenorrhea with no further study of ovulation, or hyperandrogenism, or vice versa. In the final analysis, 169 women were included. Of these, those 18 who I described with an uncertain diagnosis, they were not included. And then there were 4 lost to follow-up in the PCOS group, 23 lost to follow-up in the control group, and actually 2 deaths in the control group after surgery. We don't have any additional information about those deaths, but something that we could discuss in the discussion. And then when we look at table one, we saw of the baseline characteristics before and then after surgery, there was no significant difference in age, weight, BMI, the fasting serum glucose level, insulin levels, or the HOMA-IR between the two groups. After surgery, both groups did see a rise in sex hormone binding globulin, SHBG, and the PCOS group had normalization of their total testosterone and free testosterone levels after surgery such that they were no different than the controls.
And I think at this point, this is usually where it's really helpful when you look at this table one, typically the first table in these studies, to try to understand your risk for confounding. And we've talked about this in previous episodes, but what confounding is something that's going to be related to your exposure of interest. So again, in this situation, it would be PCOS is what has been labeled as the exposure. And so it's something that would be related to that exposure, but is actually the cause of the outcome or affects the cause. And those are always important to think about because what you don't want to do is mistakenly label what you have called your exposure as being the driving factor in an outcome when it's only an associated factor, a confounder. And table one is often a very good place to try to get a sense of how worried you are about confounding. And what you do is you look at the two groups, the exposed and the unexposed groups, to see how different they are. And the more different those two groups are, the more worried you get about the possibility of confounding, because these groups in these observational studies are not randomly allocated. In randomized studies, they are at random split into these two groups. And so confounders don't go away in those studies, but they are perfectly balanced because of the effects of good randomization. But in observational studies, that's not the case. So you have to worry about the possibility of confounding. And you get encouraged when you see exactly what Anna pointed out, is that when you look at these two groups, they looked very similar. There were certainly differences, testosterone levels being an obvious one, but that would be expected. So that's something that would be a part of PCOS and so would not typically be considered a confounder. And so the fact that those were higher in one group but then were not different after the surgery would be exactly what you would expect. But this is where you also have to be thinking about other possibilities. So if, in fact, the groups had been substantially different, often what the authors will do is a statistical adjustment to try to account for that. And if you see that the statistical adjustment makes a substantial difference in the outcomes, then you get worried that there may be other unmeasured confounders that you're not accounting for. There was no need for a statistical adjustment here because the groups were so similar. And so we don't have that concern, but we still need to be thinking about the possibility that these groups could be different. And one thing, and I certainly would be interested in hearing Anna and Andrea chime in with any thoughts that they had on this, but I think this is where the possibility comes up that there could be different behavior because some of the individuals coming into the study already knew that they had PCOS. And then presumably after the testing, if these individuals were told the results of their testing and found out that they had PCOS, that could have changed their behavior. So there could be other things that these individuals did because they knew that they had PCOS that actually improved their fertility or worsened it. Either could be the case, but more likely the interest that we would have would be that they did something that would improve their fertility. And so it's actually not the fact that they had PCOS that was the major factor, but a change in behavior because they knew that they had PCOS. There could be many other ones. That would just be one example, very hard to account for. So nothing that the authors did incorrectly here, but something that we as readers need to be thinking about because it is an intrinsic limitation of observational studies.
Thanks, Chase. So the authors wanted to comment that two women with PCOS and three women in the control group did undergo ovulation induction, resulting in a successful pregnancy in one patient with PCOS and two in the control group. I wanted to use this as an opportunity to ask Andrea, what do we know about using agents for ovulation induction after bariatric surgery? Is there data?
There's really no data in the literature. There are no trials. Few enough trials of ovulation induction in PCOS with other forms of weight management. So unfortunately, we don't have it here.
So the results, pregnancy rates were overall higher in the PCOS group of patients who completed follow-up. It was 40.8% versus 25%. But in a restricted analysis of just the women seeking fertility, pregnancy rates were still higher. It was 95.2% in women with PCOS, which was 21 women, versus 76.9% in the control group, or 38 women. And the live birth rates were 81% and 69.2% respectively, although this was not statistically significant. Andrea, why do you think the rates were higher in the PCOS group?
I think a big problem with this study, even though they said that they were well-powered, number one, the power calculation was quite odd. They took a study that was looking at fertility after bariatric surgery, but that was not the major goal of the study. And in fact, in the study they cite, the authors say specifically, this is not a study to examine fertility outcomes after bariatric surgery. So we don't know in that study if all the subjects were trying to get pregnant. And desire for fertility is a prerequisite, obviously, for seeing pregnancy. And so they did a power analysis sort of assuming that the, I think it was 22% versus 2%, 22% pregnancy in the PCOS was, and the controls only 2% was with everybody desiring fertility. And that was not clear. The hypothesis that there should be differences in fertility after bariatric surgery and PCOS and controls isn't well-founded, in my opinion. And then in this study, when you sort of sort through and get down to the number of women in both groups who wanted fertility, you have a much, much smaller sample size. So I think that all these suggestive differences are more lack of power than any biologic difference that we're seeing in PCOS. Now, if you want to be very speculative, women with PCOS do have more oocytes and follicles, and perhaps they were having more follicular development, but then you'd expect multiple births, and we weren't seeing that. So I just think this is lack of power.
And I think Andrea's point here is really important. So that, and that's what I was alluding to before, is it's really the women who are seeking fertility, actively seeking fertility. That's the subgroup of interest. And it's not powered for that. So when they came up with their power calculation of 103 and said they're adequately powered, yes, their entire group of 169 was greater than that number. But the subgroup of women who are interested in attempting to get pregnant, which is just what Andrea pointed out, that's the group that you're interested in, is those who are attempting pregnancy, it's underpowered for that. Now, it is encouraging, at least with the point estimate, is that for individuals, for women with PCOS, the rates were higher, not lower, but still, when your numbers are less than what you have come up with your power calculation, you do get worried there that you simply don't have enough individuals to be confident in saying that there's not a difference between those two groups.
So just to finish summarizing the results, there was no difference between the two groups in time to achieving first pregnancy after surgery, and there was also no difference in the rates of complication. The mean birth rate was lower in newborns from women with PCOS compared with controls at 17.6% versus 3.7%, defined as having a low birth weight. There was no difference in neonatal complications, and the type of bariatric surgery actually had no impact on pregnancy rates. They did see some more C-sections in the control groups, versus the PCOS group, 7 versus 3, and this may have been due to the control groups having slightly larger babies. I don't know if anybody has any additional comments about those results.
I think the prevalence of low birth weight is disturbing. And that's been a signal also in some other studies, not with bariatric surgery, but with very low-calorie diet, that there's been increased prevalence of low birth weight. And low birth weight does correlate and predict other poor neonatal and even longer-term health outcomes. So why there should be this difference between the PCOS and the control group, and it was statistically significant, I don't know. I don't have a good hypothetical basis, or one would have to speculate that somehow there's a more adverse effect of caloric restriction bariatric surgery in PCOS. So I think this finding is definitely should lead to better designed studies. And I think there are two questions that we ought to be asking. One is bariatric surgery in PCOS superior to either no surgery or, let's say, other forms of caloric restriction? So that would be a PCOS with a bariatric surgery group and a PCOS without that, ideally a randomized prospective trial. It can't be blinded. And then to ask the question is, are there adverse outcomes specific to PCOS compared to normal women when they have bariatric surgery? And again, one would hope we could do a prospective trial, so, and that all the women who were examined would be seeking fertility, or that would be, you know, the design. So there are some interesting questions. This is obviously a very difficult area to study. It's expensive, and you know, you need to have a patient population who wants to do it. But that is a disturbing finding, the low birth weight.
Sure.
At this point, we will transition into the discussion. And as usual, I'll walk you through the conclusions that the authors come to. But then we'll give you some of our own thoughts about that, any questions that we think maybe haven't been answered quite as well as they should be, any caveats that we would suggest. And then, as always, we'll try to end with the question of, should this change our practice, or perhaps not yet? So for what the authors conclude, several different points that they make. So they state that the high pregnancy and fertility rates rates in women with PCOS after bariatric surgery are seen, so especially in those seeking fertility, as you would expect. And then they also point out that these outcomes are similar to those in the control group. They point out that largely the maternal and neonatal complications were rare in both of those groups, and that the only difference between the groups were the slightly lower frequency of birth weight. And we've talked about that already as an important one. Also puzzling here, no clear explanation for that, as Andrea walked us through already. And I did, and I'll quote here, because I do think that the authors stated their conclusions in an accurate way. And so I'll quote them here as how they describe them. And it's that our present results might suggest that bariatric surgery in obese women with PCOS could be a useful means of achieving fertility. We'll come back to this at the very end as far as changing practice. But I think as far as authors taking what is observational data, which is challenging because of the possibility for confounders and unexplained results, and having to be very careful in how you phrase that. And I think at least from that perspective, the authors did a good, reasonable job of doing that. The authors also walk through several other studies that have been done already and point out that their data is similar to other studies and their findings. A few of the limitations that the authors point out. So they mention that a higher percentage of the women with PCOS compared to the controls were interested in fertility, and the actual numbers of that 43% versus 32% in terms of the possibility of introducing a bias. I think this is similar to what we talked about before, in that there may be different motivations for individuals, whether you had PCOS or did not have PCOS, in undergoing surgery. And that's more evidence that there could be a bias from that perspective, that if you wanted to speculate and you said individuals who have PCOS could perhaps be under the impression that achieving pregnancy could be more challenging for them, and so change their behavior and so underwent different changes that could have increased the chances of fertility. So just as examples of how confounding works, that would be one way. And the authors do point out that there may be a clue in that, given that there were a higher percentage of women interested in fertility in the exposed versus the unexposed group. The authors point out that there may be some limitation based on the lack of ovarian imaging. Those we talked about already may not be a huge impact for the outcomes of interest from our perspective. And it's also been mentioned, as Andrea brought up already, that there was not a control group of obese women who were not operated on. Because that would be another big question that you have. If you're only comparing people, all of whom had surgery, your big question would be, well, what if you didn't have surgery at all? Does surgery clearly improve fertility rates as opposed to not having surgery? And so they point out that in this study, that's not something that they're able to answer because they don't have that as a control group. And as a final limitation, they point out that there was no assessment of the male partners. And so there could be an underappreciated aspect to some of the fertility challenges that individuals in the study were experiencing. The strengths of the study that the authors point out, the first one, which we've already talked about already, is as they point out that their study was adequately powered. And I think that would be the big point of disagreement that we would have, is that it's not adequately powered for what exactly they're looking at. That is fertility in women who are actively seeking fertility. That's the group that we would really be interested in. So it's underpowered for that. So a caveat that we would have to that. Additionally, they point out, as far as the strength goes, is that they did a rigorous job in identifying all of the premenopausal women in their institution who underwent bariatric surgery, that they had a very good collection of pre- and post-operative data and outcomes, and that also the prevalence of PCOS in this group was what would be expected based on other observational data. So I think from my perspective, agree that those are all strengths, particularly with the data collection, can be very hard. It is usually, to get good data collection, you often need a prospective study so that you are identifying and determining exactly what data you want collected up front. That's often the only way to ensure you get all the data that you want. So I agree, for a retrospective study to have all of this data available would be considered a strength. It's often not something that is achieved with these studies. So now what we'll do is we'll spend the rest of our time thinking about changing clinical practice? Do these results influence the care that we provide? So before we get to that specific question, I think it'd just be good for as us as a group overall to discuss the overall quality of this study. How well done was this study, particularly with the challenges, as Andre has pointed out already, of doing such a study?
I think that, as you pointed out, Chase, they do have pretty complete data collection. They report that they did contact all of the subjects. So I think those are strengths and give us some confidence in the outcomes. And I think really the major limitation is kind of a disconnect when they talk about the power, and they don't really address the fact that when you get down to the group of interest, the study was underpowered. But it is comprehensive. It is very hard to do this sort of work. And I think it's an important addition to the literature for those of us who manage women with PCOS.
Andre, I'll ask you a follow-up question then about the challenge of this. So obviously with these sort of studies, the gold standard is always an RCT. And so that's always what you want to see if possible. If you had to speculate, how feasible would it be to answer this type of question with an RCT? Do you think that's something that could realistically be done, or the logistics and the number of women that you would need to recruit for the study would be so high that it might not be feasible or realistic for a study like that to happen in the future?
I think a study like this could be feasible with a group like the Reproductive Medicine Network, which was an NICHD-supported network of reproductive endocrinologists who executed clinical trials. And that's where the PPCOS-1 of metformin and clomiphene and PPCOS-2 of clomiphene versus letrozole. And they really showed feasibility. They had 600, 500 subjects recruited. And there's a huge desire in women with PCOS, both for fertility and for weight loss. So I do think you could do this trial. It's going to take a while. It's going to be expensive, but it's an important question.
So I also agree. I thought that this was a very important trial to add to the literature. I was disturbed by the two deaths in the control group, and I wished that they had provided more information about what happened there, just because if I, you know, when I refer somebody for bariatric surgery, I generally tell them that it's a very safe procedure with low risk of morbidity and mortality. And so it's just something that I wish we had more data on.
And I think to finish up, Andrea, I'll ask you to give us an overview, and not just this study in and of itself, but put this in a little bit of a larger context for us, a clinical context for those of us who take care of patients with PCOS and try to give them recommendations, sort through a large amount of observational data to try to understand what's the best approach here? What's the standard of care? What should we be considering? So if we think about all of the options that are on the table here, if we are thinking about bariatric surgery for these individuals, if we're actually thinking about employing the assistance of our reproductive endocrinology colleagues and thinking about advanced reproductive techniques to employ here, or if we're actually just thinking about something else entirely, so medical weight loss as an example. So do we employ that, and could that maybe achieve similar results? So if you think about this particular study in the context of a much larger body of evidence, trying to take all of that, sort through all of that, and see how that should affect the care that we provide to our patients. How do you think about that overall, and then how does this study potentially contribute to that understanding in your approach?
Weight management, particularly in my patient population as a medical endocrinologist, is probably one of the top reasons that women come to see me. The situation is much better now that we have some effective anorectic drugs. We're using a lot of GLP-1 receptor agonists and getting good weight loss, certainly not the magnitude of weight loss you see with bariatric surgery. But I think bariatric surgery is a very good option for these women. And there are safer approaches being developed, endoscopic approaches, which may substantially reduce the already low risks to bariatric surgery. And the patient outcomes, again, this is personal. There aren't any big studies limited just to PCOS, but I see in my practice very good. And interestingly, one of the things that improves a lot is mood and anxiety and depression. I think body image really has an adverse effect on PCOS. What this study adds is now when I discuss bariatric surgery, I can say that there are data in the literature to support that the pregnancy outcomes are not horrendous, that it looks like, you know, there are good chances for fertility and pregnancy. There's some concern about low birth weight that I think needs to be sorted out and is definitely higher than we see with assisted reproductive technologies. And I think the final thing that we need to remember is that even BMI below obese levels substantially adversely affects pregnancy outcomes. And so we don't want our patients, we want them to be in the best body weight possible before they conceive. And we're sort of lax in the United States about that. In more regulated countries like the UK with national health systems, they in fact don't allow women to have IVF if their BMIs are above certain thresholds. So I think it is important to do everything to have maternal health pre-pregnancy be optimal. And this can be a very effective way to achieve that.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? If you use a medication like a GLP-1 receptor agonist, what are you telling your patients about the goals of how long they could expect to be on that, and then how long they should stop it before they try to conceive?
Well, we don't have good data on what the time should be. And frequently what happens, and it's sort of the dirty little secret of PCOS studies, is many, many women with PCOS do want to become pregnant. And in our studies, we all have a background rate of pregnancy, even when you've counseled, not to become pregnant. So there's just the literature on GLP-1 receptor agonists and PCOS, the studies are very small. We just don't have good data. And there's only one study where the weight loss dose, the 3 milligrams, has been used in PCOS. All the other studies are with lower doses. So we need those studies to know how long they should be on it, and then how long it should be stopped before they try to conceive.
And with that, I would like to thank Anna Goldman and Andrea Dunay for joining us for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did. Next month's episode will be released in mid-October, and I hope that you will join us again then. And now, you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.